This is the Paula Gordon Show, conversations with people at the leading edge. Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon, Christopher Dickey has graced us with his presence. We're talking about the world as well as talking about New York. You have experience with terror all over the world. And I say terror, not terrorism. Terror, being terrified. On 9/11, I came upstairs and said, Bill, turn on the TV, something really bad is happening, and we watched the second tower go down, and then he said, Paula, turn it off. I said, but, he said, we're not going to know anything for a long time. It's going to be a lot of noise, but we aren't going to know anything for the foreseeable future. Coming to securing the city and thinking about being terrified and what happens to us individually and culturally and the world when we are in a state of terror, isn't that part of what your story is how to get beyond being just frozen in terror so that you can begin to see what really happened?
Well, I think that's exactly right. But I also was amazed. I was in New York on 9/11. And I was stunned by the resilience of the New Yorkers. Their ability not to accept it, because I don't think anybody's forgotten it, not in New York City anyway, but to stand up straight and get on with their lives. It was really stunning. It was the most amazing thing. And there is tremendous strength in that. And if you don't undermine it by trying to make the fear artificial, by having red alerts and orange alerts anytime you're a bureaucrat and you want to cover your ass, then you have a tremendous strength of character in the community and in the city to work with, where people will instinctively try to make themselves feel safe. Now, you want, I think the balance has to be one in which they're alert. The slogan on the subways in New York is, if you see something, say something. You definitely don't want people, you know, dragging a massive backpack or duffel bag onto the subway and then getting off at the next stop and everybody going, huh.
No.
You don't want that. But you do want, you want people to be alert enough so that they see things like that. But you don't want people looking over their shoulders all the time.
Well, you say that, and then you look at America post-9/11 and the world post-9/11 and what did happen. Please tell us about what happened in March of 2003 that you say was such an opportunity.
Well, I mean, I think what happened in March of 2003 is that basically we had won the war against the people who carried out 9/11. It's true that Ayman Zawahiri and Osama bin Laden were still off in the mountains someplace. But all the key architects and operatives of 9/11 and of other major attacks like the bombing of the USS Cole in Yemen, all of them had been captured. In fact, it's a credit to the CIA and to its organization that during that period of time, it was able to work with other intelligence services, keep the focus on what was needed, and to get these guys. And the invasion of Afghanistan was helpful in that. But that was an extremely limited military operation. And as of 2003, the Bush administration might have said, we've won, and we're going to keep after bin Laden, we're going to keep supporting the efforts to find him in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and now we're going to get on to the business with living our lives. But they didn't, of course. March 2003 was precisely the moment when the Bush administration decided it had to go to war with Iraq, which is actually something it had been planning to do since the end of 2001. And it was just a stunning mistake. It did nothing except create more hatred of America, broaden the pool from which terrorists draw their recruits, make it harder to get intelligence, and ultimately bog the United States down in a war that costs about $2.5 billion a week. And the sole purpose of spending that money is essentially to keep Americans in a country where they're not wanted.
It's easy to be skeptical and perhaps even cynical if someone believes in a unitary presidency, and if someone believes...
A unitary presidency? You're not thinking of Dick Cheney, are you?
As one example, yes. Part of the requirement, of course, is that that applies in a time of war, and if you can somehow construct an infinite war, then you get to have a unitary presidency pretty much forever. And I think there is a mindset that was not particularly interested in declaring victory and moving on to life as usual, that was really much more interested in this, and it had political benefits.
I think there's a tendency when we talk about those days to try and isolate one element or another and say this was the reason. Unitary presidency or oil or they really did think there was WMD or...
All of the above.
All of the above.
Yeah.
The problem was precisely that there were so many, from the Bush administration's point of view, so many good reasons to go into Iraq that they ignored the one huge bad reason, which is that we were going to wind up occupying the country and having and creating more problems than we solved. They just couldn't see it. They would not, literally would not see it. This was the famous lesson with General Shinseki when he says it's going to take years and hundreds of thousands of troops.
What? They fired him.
They fired him. Goodbye. We don't want him around. We don't want that message getting out there because people might step back. You know, we don't want to go on and on about Iraq. It's a little bit far afield from the NYPD, but...
It's right in the heart of the NYPD.
But it's right in the heart of the problem that I wrote the book to try to address. Because it's obvious that invading and occupying countries is not a good way to solve the issue of terrorism. Take the advantage, look at Israel. See, 1967, so that's 32 years since Israel occupied the West Bank and Gaza. Huh. If invading and occupying were the solution to terrorism, there shouldn't be any problem there. And I don't think we can say that.
Richard Ben Kramer wrote a book called How Israel Lost, and it is directly premised on when you become an occupier, you have changed the game and you lose.
Look, I don't know why American Southerners don't understand this. Because the American Southerners, we're sitting here in Atlanta, American Southerners ought to be the first people to understand this. When I was a little boy going to school here in Atlanta, it was 100 years after the Civil War, and we used to teach ourselves the words to a song called Good Old Rebel. You know this song, Good Old Rebel? I won't sing, I'll spare you the song, but the words are real important. The key verse is, it's all about the occupation of the South by the North. You know, and there's this great verse where it says, 300,000 Yankees is stiff in Southern dust. Yeah, we got 300,000 before they conquered us. They died of Southern fever and Southern steel and shot. But I wish it was 3 million instead of what we got. Now, if that was the sentiment that was being shared among school children 100 years after the end of the Civil War, why on earth do we think that people who are occupied by powers that do not share their faith, that do not share their language, and do not share their culture are going to forget that? And this is one of the reasons that the Europeans, and the French particularly, were adamant when they were talking to the Americans about going into Iraq. Everybody in Europe, every country in Europe, has either been an occupier or been occupied or both within living memory. They all know what this is about and the kind of hatreds that it engenders. And the Bush administration... Well, you know, Bush was a fake Southerner. He wouldn't know these things. But you know, they should understand. People should understand that that's what this is about. I'm not saying that this is the root of all evil, but it is a huge problem.
One of the things that I don't want to run out of time before talking about is when you talk about that 40% of New Yorkers who are born other places, that key element of that first generation of people who come to America, as compared to the second and third generation, seems to me to be a much bigger issue, and I sort of set this before we go away, that if, in fact, we were to live the American dream instead of just talk about it, you'd be addressing all kinds of roots of terror, not just among people born elsewhere.
I think there are lots of issues here that we could talk about even longer than we're going to go, but the American dream, the Protestant ethic, it's really an immigrant dream and an immigrant ethic. And there's nothing about it that has to be Protestant. You can be Hindu, you can be Muslim, you can be Jewish, you can be Catholic, you can be an atheist. When people come to the United States, they come to the United States to build their futures. They come because they buy into the dream. This is really the secret of security in New York City, and in fact in most of the big cities in the United States where there are high proportions of first-generation immigrants. The problem, I mean, in fact, if you look at the list of the top 10 safest cities, I think 8 of them are all heavy.
Starting with El Paso, which is,
El Paso
sits on the border.
North there in Juarez, but people in El Paso, they want to keep things quiet. When you look at that, you know, you start to understand that safety is about, it's about the way people feel in the society, about the possibilities it gives them. And if there's a problem with immigration, then there is, and you see this in L.A., it's when you have second and third generation children of immigrants who didn't come of their own free will. They're here, and they feel cut off from the possibilities of the society. Their parents may not have succeeded enough. They may be cut off for linguistic or cultural or racial reasons. But when you get that, then you start to see a reaction. But that's a slightly different issue.
We'll be back in just a moment with Christopher Dickey so that we can continue this conversation. Stay with us.